You're wearing a Bears? Bears?
Remember the Bad News Bears?
Chico's Bail Bond and Bad News Bears? Yeah.
Okay.
Big Walter Matthau fan in my house.
Well, Walter Matthau had his great moments. Yeah. He really did. What was the Hitchcock movie? Audrey Hepburn, I think.
It's not Hitchcock, it's Charade.
It's Charade, yeah.
Yeah, but it's a Stanley Donen like working like Hitchcock, right? Yeah.
Right. It's terrific. Yeah. Yeah, he's really good in it.
Did you ever see Charlie Varick?
I have, but I couldn't tell you anything that happened in that movie.
You know, small time corn pone bank robber knocks over a small time corn pone bank that happens to be a way station for a mob money laundering operation. He thinks he's coming out with, you know, 11 or 12 grand, has 800 grand.
Uh-huh.
It's great. Yeah. Don Siegel picture. It's really terrific.
Yeah. Nice. Well, we should do a couple of intros.
Yes.
And then figure out which one. I'll figure out later which one to keep.
All right.
But let's get rolling on that.
All right.
Yeah, you're good. I have with me today a gentleman of prodigious skills.
Oh, no.
I will list, for those of you not acquainted with Mr. Fraction, author, comic book writer, Eisner Award-winning comic book writer. That's the Academy Awards of comic book writing.
Correct? That's what they tell me. That's what they tell me.
That's what they tell you, right. Known for his work. Oh, my goodness. Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen for DC Comics. Hawkeye for Marvel Comics. Casanova and Sex Criminals. That's an interesting title. The Immortal Iron Fist, Uncanny X-Men. It's a long list. It's a very long list. It says here in my notes that you are also a championship bathtub farter. Is that true? Or is there some kind? How did you develop those kinds of skills?
You know, perseverance, small ball, kind of just never forgetting your basics, you know, it's fundamental.
And the square bubble that supposedly you've perfected?
It's we're working on it. The boys down in the lab have some exciting developments for the Olympics. So keep your eyes on Paris next year.
All right. We'll do. I mean, it's good to have a hobby, but that's something more than that.
I'm on strike. I got to do something.
Okay. Well, you could always alphabetize something.
Oh, that's true. That's right. Right.
All right.
Your list of
comic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our topic today.
It's weird going through like your life's like, oh shit, that's my last 20 years of my life in a box.
Right. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. No, time.
Yeah.
I just put out a newsletter for the studio and talked about my new talent, which is getting older. I'm getting older every day. Not everyone has, I guess, well, I suppose other people can pretend to get as old as me, but I think I'm really got it down. I could do it left-handed. Anyway, so you come from Chicagoland. I can say that.
Yeah, Chicagoland.
What high school did you go to?
I wasn't there for high school. We moved around every year or two. But I was in the greater Chicagoland area till I was about 8. And then I went back to go to Columbia in my wayward youth. One of the many universities I dropped out of was Columbia College, Chicago.
No kidding. I had some friends who went to Columbia. Yeah. Well, I grew up in that region myself. I made it all the way through high school and then got the heck out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got the heck out. Mostly because of summers.
Yeah, ironically. Yeah. The first year I went back was the year it was 108. That Chicago heat wave.
It's not just 108. It's 100% or 99% humidity. Yeah, just in the realm of awful, like you can't imagine. It's just terrible.
Yeah.
So I thought
surely the Pacific Northwest, this will be the place to hide out. Well, we inexorably slouch into Mad Max Fury Road territory, but
yeah,
apparently
there's
it's here now too.
Yeah, there's no place to hide now. I'm in touch with some guys down in Texas, and so they're down near Houston, so it's just muggy and upper 90s every day, every day.
You know, that's the great thing about Houston is it's all the best parts of a desert and a swamp.
I don't get it, but everyone believes they're in the best place ever. I don't know why that is, but it just seems to be. Yeah. Most people don't leave home. They stay there and they grow up there and they matriculate and marry and all that. So go figure.
Yeah, my wife is a military kid. Sorry. Okay. She moved all the time too. And this was kind of like the one place we hadn't lived between the two of us here in New England. And she's not a fan of winters. So, and I'd been to Portland a lot in the 90s. And so we came out here in 2009.
Oh, really?
And just like immediately fell in love. Just like, oh, I found my biodiversity region.
Oh, it's pretty great. Yeah, in terms of, I was going to say climate, but this week it's pretty awful. But in terms of geography, there's few places in the world like it where you can go from one extreme to another extreme so quickly. So that's pretty great. Does that you've written all over the world. How do you find this climate for writing?
You know, it's great. Like it's and we got out here and had an offer on a house that fell apart on inspection. And then we're just crashing on our friend's couch. And my son was maybe a year and a half at that point, almost two. And while we were living on this couch in my friend's house over on the southeast off of Hawthorne, we found out my wife was pregnant with our second. At which point it was like, all right, so we're just going to rent the biggest house we can find with the biggest backyard. Like we got two dogs, we got two cats. We're going to have two kids. Let's just get our stuff out here, figure the town out, figure out where we're going to live, which of these six quadrants we're going to choose.
Right.
But that sent us to Beaverton, and we were just immediately fell in love with the Southwest. And it was just sort of like, oh, there's giant trees in my backyard and deer and elk. And like, it's great. It's like, oh, why would you live in why would we pay twice as much for half the space to live off Hawthorne or something? Like, it'd be great if you were in your 20s or whatever. I don't need to walk to my local anymore. I don't need to do that stuff. I like the backyard and I like the woods. So it's great, especially when it rains, you know, just it's like a living in a white noise machine or something.
I have been in Portland over 50 years and I can travel into Southwest and get lost like that. It's like sheep paths. They laid the place out, you know, for the sheep, and the roads are twisting. And, you know, I found a road. This will get edited out. But I found a road from the zoo to Lake Oswego along West Hills. There's ways you can, you know, stay off the freeways and just drive the top of the West Hills. And that's kind of fun. But I've also been in places where I do? I don't know where I am. So
it's magic. You go through that tunnel on 26 and it just, oh, wow. Where am I? I've just suddenly arrived in Twin Peaks. You know, this was a city a second ago and now it's
different.
Yeah.
I got a student who's out in Cedar Mill and he's got 40 acres out there.
Wow.
It's an amazing place. And he's been out there since he was a kid, but built a house and now he's surrounded by all these tech guys from Intel and whoever. And they're all living in these houses with about 4 feet between these giant houses because no one needs a yard, right? You've got your internet connection, so no one needs a yard.
Yeah.
It's just such a strange way to live. And there's Carl and his
40 acres is good.
40 acres is amazing. But He was one of my very first master students, the very first year we had a mastery program. And I used to go to the students and visit their shop and take my beagle out there. And after you know, Carl and I had talked for an hour or so, and then I spent the next hour looking for my beagle, who was out having a good old time chasing something. So yeah,
those mice aren't going to break their own necks.
He loved it out there, I say. He loved it. But we have a topic to address, and it's, I don't know, I don't really feel like it. It's called discipline. You know, I don't feel like it. I don't feel like doing it today. Maybe we should come back another day and do it. It's probably the single most important thing I learned in school was how to discipline myself. Not to learn calculus, which I did. I don't have any understanding or, you know, write 30 pages on a novel or, you know, all those things you were forced to do to get through school. None of that stuff do I retain, but the discipline is probably the most important thing. Where did you learn yours? Do you have any? I don't mean to presume.
No, yeah, you know, it's, I have it for my work, you know, and I think I'm kind of stealing a line from John Irving, or at least paraphrasing it badly, but like he says, he's, you know, he's not got an abundance of talent, but he can work harder than anybody else. And so it, you know, I feel like that, you know, but only like my personal discipline, very soft. My professional discipline is like iron. I can show up for the work, and it's always the personal stuff that gets cut on the list of things to do in a day when the work demands it. You know, the busier things are, the worse care I take care of myself because I need more time to. It's arguably not discipline, but it feels like, you know, discipline looping so far around into like anarchy.
Well, I mean, if you're, are we talking about sitting down and writing, or are we talking about something else?
I get writing in the specific. Yeah. It's the thing about kind of the woodworking is there. I'm such a novice that there will come a point where my hands just can't do it anymore, or I can't focus my eyes anymore. Mm-hmm. Because I've not been doing it, you know, for every day for 20 years or whatever. With writing, I could sit down and just however long I'm, you know, I can just go forever. But so it's, I guess I'm talking about writing in the specific. I can. Sure. I think it was kind of the day it was something about the day I became a writer was the day I stopped wondering what it's going to be like to be a writer and just started writing. And I'm not one of those guys that like, you have to write 5 pages every day or anything like that.
I was going to ask,
You know, I see the value in it for some people. I don't for, you know, I also see its lack of value for others.
How about for yourself?
It comes and goes. You know, I tend to get itchy if I go a couple of days without writing anything. Mm-hmm. So I'm in a real itchy place right now. Extra weird. But like, I don't know. I think it was a gift of school for me as well. And I went to an art school my senior year of high school. So I lived in a dorm at the North Carolina School of the Arts. Now it's the University of North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. But, you know, I was living in a dorm. I was, you know, an hour and a half away from where my parents were. It was, you know, functional college life, and it's competitive entry and competitive continuance. So they got their budgets from the state every year. They didn't need our tuition. In fact, we paid very little tuition being in-state residents. That's when my folks lived in North Carolina at the time. So they don't, there's not a lot, there was no coddling there, you know? And, you know, I think my class started with maybe 35 kids, and I think 15 of us graduated. And I learned it there.
And did it, I mean, you're, I don't know how to wrestle this one. I learned to write in high school and in college, and was forced to, as a literature major, forced to produce all sorts of drivel.
Oh, you were a literature major?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Just pages and pages. What do you need 30 pages on? It's not going to say anything, but I can give it to you. But being a writer was something I thought I would do, and then I found a different path and veered off rather dramatically. In your bio, you were at a forum. Mr. Ellis, was that his name?
Yeah. Like a virtual, like a web forum, you know, kind of like what it did, like a Discord server in slow motion.
I see. And you met kind of some important people then.
Yeah.
Including your wife.
Yeah. It's writing is real solitary, and writing comics, especially when you're trying to break in, is even more solitary. But it was as close to being in like a band and there being a scene as I could ever imagine there being for comics people. There's a whole group of us that kind of met there and still are in contact with one another and work together. And that's kind of like, it was like my class all kind of arrived at the same time. And that was kind of one of the places we went through, but it was a place to like hang out all day while we were figuring our craft out and talk to each other about it, you know?
Right.
Just going to see one another shitty bands doing bad covers and like, you know, figuring it out.
I think it's so interesting, the idea that there are these moments in our lives when we're young, and I don't call them forks in the road, I call them spoons in the road. Because they're not, it's not like, oh, I'm going to go here or I'm going to go here. You're going to sort of go, well, maybe I'll just go around this bend and then I'll take, you know, it's not, this is the moment that is going to change my life. But then it ends up changing your life,
right?
You know, by attending that forum. I just think it's so interesting. And you don't have a clue. I mean, did you know going into it, hey, this is really going to be a great, important.
No, you know, and the first time I was there, you know, it still was on dial up. I mean, it was proto internet, you know, it was sort of as the internet was happening, it was a place where people gathered to talk about comics. And that was just, oh, all right, that's fun. That's neat.
Right.
And it became this kind of place where a bunch of us incubated is really interesting.
It sounds, and I'm guessing that you co-write a lot of comics. Is that true or am I misreading?
I've co-written a couple of things, but I tend to write for myself. But so it's so collaborative. I think there's a case to be made that like really all comic writers are co-writers. You know, I had an intern once and I had him count the words. I gave him a pile of scripts and a pile of printed comics. And I was like, tell me how many words are in the comic versus how many words are in the script. And it was like 3/5 of what I write, no one but the artist ever sees.
Yeah. Interesting.
So I'm writing for him. You know what I mean? Or her.
Right. I was wondering about the collaborative nature and, you know, learning your craft with others and how that affects. I can't imagine writing with someone else. I mean, it's just
needs to have a. It helps, like, you know, my wife and I and a friend got asked to pitch a TV show once, and the three of us all kind of had our own lanes that we were interested in. Like, if the show's called Shirt and Pants, you want to write about shirts and I want to write about pants. Great. You know, and it just kind of worked because we weren't all dogpiling for the same, you know, piece of red meat or whatever. But talk about discipline. I think there's kind of having some kind of confidence in my craft. That, like, my favorite part of the process these days is, like, I call it de-writing. It's not rewriting, but like I'll write the thing. The artist draws it, I get it back, And now I get to go through and get rid of as many words as possible.
Interesting.
Like I want to remove as much of my presence on the page as I can. It's a visual medium, right? It's pictures and big blobs of text. Destroy that, right? So I want to be like a Amy Hempel or E.E. Cummings. Like I want to use the right three words. I want to write like a samurai. Like I want to use the right three words instead of the right enough 30 words.
Right. Yeah.
Which I think is a kind of discipline. Like that sort of, I don't need to remind everyone, no, I'm a writer. The writer's here. Everyone, the writer's here. You know, I can remove myself from that because I think I'm a good collaborator, and that was a gift of art school. You know, I think I'm just being a fan of comics. I have some quality for looking at an artist and recognizing what it is about their work that I personally respond to, and then writing into that.
So you're not given a here's the story or here's the character or this is what we want. You're just
sometimes, you know, if you work for like Marvel or DC, sometimes it'll be like, hey, we wanted this. And like, okay. And if it's a character that, if it's Spider-Man, you know, all right, well, there's gonna be power, there's gonna be responsibility, there's gonna be webs, there's gonna be these casts, you know, it's all established. It's, you know, 70 years of continuity or whatever.
Right.
Other times you can go to them and say, what about this character in A, B, C, D? And they'll go for it or maybe not. But there's a, you know, that's sort of like writing as a, you know, relay race. Someone's going to hand you a baton and you get to hold it for a while and run with it. And then you're going to have to hand it to somebody else, you know?
Well, things have come to mind that reported that Hitchcock said he writes the movie and then he comes back and writes the dialogue, which is, you know, sounds very much like that de-writing approach of yours where you remove stuff. I have a friend who hung out with David Mamet in the early days, and she said that, he would just be ruthless with his own words, just pulling stuff out, just tearing stuff out of his scripts. So
That's another thing about TV writing. Like we talked about this, you know, the Sondheim book and stuff, and like, you know,
what's on
comic?
Which Sondheim book was it?
Finishing the Hat.
Finishing the Hat, right? Which is a book on lyrics.
Yeah, it's his kind of. But the first, you know, 40 pages or so is like an essay about, oh, here's how to write. Here's how I write, and here's how I write songs, and. You know, he makes this point of, all right, so I've got da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And in that rhythm and in that space, I need this character to say, I love you. I love you more than anything. I hate myself because of it. I can never let you know. And the car is on fire. What is the right words? What are the right, how do I get all that into da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da?
Right.
And in, you know, in comics, you've got a finite page. You know, it's not a novel. I can't just write, oh, this one's, you know, unless you're writing a graphic novel, which is a different animal. But like a comic book, those magazines have stable fixed formats. You know, it's 32 pages. There's 20 pages of comics and 12 pages of ads.
No kidding.
Or whatever, you know. So like every chapter, it'd be weird if you had to write a book and every chapter had to be 20 pages.
Yeah. But what it brings up is this other idea, which is that of limits and how freeing they can become.
Yeah. Yeah.
In a certain way.
Yeah. I love shapes. I love those shapes.
Yeah. It's everyone thinks, oh, well, I need complete artistic freedom. It's terrifying to have complete artistic freedom. You can do whatever you want. Well, there's 10,000 things I want to do. How do I narrow it down?
Right.
And I think that takes discipline to narrow your focus and say, this is what I like, or this is what I'm good at, or no more iambic pentameter for me, by God.
Right. Like form has to follow function, right?
Oh, now. Oh, he just opened a whole can of worms or box of vermicelli or something. Oh, my God. Form follows failure. Form doesn't follow function. Here's what I'm sorry.
What does that mean? Unpack that for me.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Why don't you go on?
No.
The form of objects, I'll keep it in the realm of objects, three-dimensional objects, oftentimes is a mishmash of things that kind of work, but then the designer says, oh, I can't do that. It doesn't work because it just failed. And this is based largely on the writings of a guy named Henry Petrosky, who I enjoy quite a bit, North Carolina area, Duke. Is it okay to say Duke University?
Sure.
To a UNC grad, who writes about that concept, the evolution of useful things. He wrote a great book on the pencil. One book he wrote about bridges, and every 30 years, there's a massive bridge failure. And all the bridge engineers go, oh my God, you mean we can't do that? Because, you know, all the computer models said, yeah, you can, or before computer modeling, their studies, their calculations said, oh yeah, you can do that. And then that bridge in wherever it was up near Seattle, seen pictures of waving back and forth in the wind. And then, you know, these things in the real world don't survive. So getting that catastrophic sometimes evidence is really important for the design of pieces. So the function of it is, and this is also, I just lost his name. I'll think of it. David Pye's book on design talks about how, if we were really good at designing airplanes, they would never fall out of the sky.
Right.
I mean, we're getting better at it, but they would never fall out of the sky. Rocket ships would never blow up if we were really good at it, but these things happen. Right. And they happen because of failure. And from those failures, like the O-ring failure on the Challenger that Richard Feynman pointed out.
I literally was talking about that last night.
Oh, really? Yeah. You can't let the O-rings freeze.
Right, right.
You can't do that. Right? So that's why I jumped on you. Yeah, sorry.
No.
The failure part is so important to design. And yeah, it's a modernist trope that form follows function, but it's not always true. It's not always true. And now in the world of comics, that may be something completely different. I will step aside. Sorry.
No, that, I think these are two correct things.
Could be,
you know, or you know, maybe it's that content follows form, right, rather than function. And you know, and also I think the thing about discipline is you get like getting knocked down 8 times, but you get up the 9th time. You know, right? That there's I think absolutely. Failure is critical. Failure is the most important part. Failure is how you learn, right? It helps if people aren't on the bridge or in the rocket. It helps if you don't need Richard Feynman in front of a press conference dunking an O-ring in a glass of a pitcher of ice water to prove his point.
Yeah.
You know, I think I burn through notebooks, right? Yeah. I think, and they're cheap, you know, they're marbled, you know, composition books. That's like a writer's sketchbook, right? It's where you go to suck, where no one has to see you suck. And you can just, you know, you fail in little ways. It's easier to fail in little ways.
Right.
You know, but I think I think that having that shape defined lets you know what is, what, how to, how to, fill it, you know? Not even, you know, sort of literally, I did some work in advertising and got to, I always sort of thought of myself as the art to suit translator. And I think it was a thing of art school and having to kind of always defend your work and talk about it. But I got good at trying to explain to these big ad agencies why they should give us money to, oh, you like this story. We got called in. This is how I learned this lesson. We got called in for a gig for Pop-Tarts. And it was when there was still kind of cartoons on TV Saturday morning. And they wanted to make like Pop-Tarts for boys. I don't know. They wanted to make a commercial that's going to appeal to boys. And me and my buddies, we, you know, had this company that we had started and did this kind of thing. We sat down and like, all right, let's just, what would be amazing if you were, you know, and we just started to kind of pile on these crazy ideas. And so we made this kind of, our pitch was we were to make this kind of Rube Goldberg factory in space where aliens were kind of putting, you would follow the Pop-Tart on the assembly line as all these completely ridiculous over the top, visually spectacular things were happening to make a Pop-Tart. But then at the end, as the Pop-Tart is coming out of the conveyor belt towards camera, you would see this kind of large, like a alien bug, like pooping out frosting on each Pop-Tart, like secreting the frosting, secreting. Right?
A secretion, yes.
And the minute, I don't remember if we said pooping or secreting, but whatever the word was, the minute it came out of my mouth, I saw we lost the job.
Oh, interesting.
The lesson was, don't let the, if you're trying to sell Pop-Tarts, don't let the bug poop on the Pop-Tart. Right?
And let's everyone know this important lesson. I think we'll have this on our website.
Right. It was just these are people who are trying to sell food. Right? That is an inappropriate, it is funny and great and cool as it would have been. It is not the message. And it sort of became like, oh, okay. You know, if you want to tell a story about the global economic inequities and how they're far more disruptive and harmful to our population over generations than nearly anything else happening on Earth, I don't know that the Incredible Hulk is the place to do it.
So
maybe not.
Given that you have a character generally, or you've come up with a character and have a I'm looking for a word larger than huge, hugely important visual aspect of this character that you are trying to prop up with your language. That gives you that, the road just gets set, doesn't it? I would think that you have this, all right, so there's, it's interesting you mentioned John Irving earlier. One of the things I remember him talking about was he writes the ending of his stories first, which I think is a very interesting approach. There are so many how-to books on writing, and many of them are like, oh, it's a mystery and you have to wait for the mystery and see how it, you know, works itself out. And he's like, nah, screw it. So you write the ending first. Yeah. Do you write the ending first yourself? Do you know the ending?
I always liken it to like if we're going to take a road trip, you and me, we're going to drive to Chicago. All right. If we find Mounties and they want to see our papers, we've gone the wrong direction. And okay. if we start seeing people in sombreros, we've also gone the wrong direction. But in a couple of days, if we don't cross the Mississippi, we should maybe figure out what's going on, right? And if this, you know, so I have the beads on the necklace, and I know where I want to end. I have no idea how I'm going to get there. Okay. Sometimes I'll know what the last line is. Sometimes I'll know what the last image is. Right. Sometimes I just know the vibe or the tone that I want to find, and we'll trust that it well, they'll get there, but it's always a little different for me. My wife writes dialogue first. She has a degree in drama, and she kind of writes her things like plays, right, where it's all just dialogue, and then she finds the visual moment and then kind of compresses. And it, to me, it's an entirely bass-ackwards way of doing things. And she looks at me like, what are you doing? How do you, amateur, you know? So
yeah.
But yeah, no, I have I also get bored. I've got a lot of issues, and I get antsy. When I get bored and I get antsy, I get in trouble. So leaving a lot of mystery, like, oh shit, I gotta make this work. I gotta figure this out. Like I need a little pressure. I need a little deadline.
Oh,
I need a little chaos.
Well, that's something I try to keep out of my world, but the deadlines, I can't work without them. I try to be as self-motivated as possible, and I chip away at the mountain, but I just wrote an article for a British woodworking magazine. I was like, oh yeah, okay, yeah. When do you need it? Yeah, I mean, if you really need it, you know. And I was just kind of hemming and hawing and lots of stuff to do this week. And he said, right away, tomorrow, like done.
Yeah.
And I just banged it out. Like, give me a deadline and I just get focused. But without those, very difficult for me to perform.
Yeah. I think that was school. I think that was art school for sure.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of the charm of working in periodical fiction is every 28 days that train's got to leave the station. I can be on it or somebody else can, you know? So there's,
can you,
and on stuff, I'm sorry.
Can you, well, if there's a 28 day cycle, lunar cycle that you have to maintain, then there's your pattern, but say that doesn't exist anymore. Can you, I don't know, you're just going to try and develop a new idea. Do you come up with ideas for deadlines? You know, if I get this much done by Thursday, then I'm going to take myself out for ice cream and peanut butter. I don't know, whatever.
Sometimes, you know, when it's something that I've made up or I'm making up with someone else, it's a little bit like having an employee. Well, if I don't write the script, you don't draw the book. And if you don't draw the book doesn't come out. The book doesn't come out. None of us get paid.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a commitment to one another that helps, you know, there's a kind of,
right.
You know, it's funny. The, the year before 2020, I was in parallel development on two TV shows at the same time. And every artist that I worked with on everything, all these kind of different original books, everybody was hungry all at the same time. Somehow, you know, like windshield wipers at a red light, suddenly they all sync up for a couple of beats and then they all go off on their own. I had a moment where all of my windshield wipers synced up. Everybody needed scripts and I was working on two TV shows. And for the first time in my life, I was late and I left people hanging and I hated it. I had an acidic, do you ever put your tongue on a 9-volt battery?
No, recently.
But you remember when you were, you know, in your wayward youth, licking batteries? I felt like that all the time.
Yes.
The stress of it. And my New Year's resolution 2020 was I never want to feel like this again.
Right.
So luckily, then there was a pandemic. So my next year's like, well, I don't feel like that anymore. So I hated it. And I was usually really good at time management and all that kind of stuff. Another thing too about having kids is like deadlines, regular deadlines, like brutal regular deadlines rob you of preciousness really quickly. Like you can't, especially if you're working for Marvel or DC, like there's got to be another Batman comic this month, period. And if you don't write it, someone else will. And, you know, so there's a relentlessness to that. But like having is you lose the preciousness of like, oh, and or but, comma, semicolon. Ooh, an M dash. Like, that just time is ticking faster and faster. And then having kids divorce me, whatever little preciousness I had left. You know, one of the biggest things I ever wrote in my entire career, I wrote on the back of a Fred Meyer receipt while my kids, the outline of it, I outlined it on a Fred Meyer receipt while my kids never slept. My kids were not nappers. And one day my wife and I were out doing errands. Both the kids fell asleep in the car seats. And she had to go into a place. She went in to do the shopping at the place. I stayed in the car with the kids. This is, you know, first rule of the first couple of years is like, if they sleep, don't wake them up. And I sat there with a Fred Meyer receipt and on the back with a failing ballpoint pen writing on my thigh, outlined an issue. And it became one of the biggest things I had ever done.
That's great.
Huh. It's like, how long do I have? I got 45 minutes. It's going to take me 45 minutes to do it. How long do I get? 4 days. It's going to take me 4 days to do it. Water. That's my water will always find its level.
Right. Wow. I was going to pose this question to you. So you get a MacArthur Fellowship.
Ooh.
And they say, go. Yeah, go. Do whatever you want. Where's your discipline come from, Ben? Maybe it goes away. I don't know. I'm waiting for mine still, so I'm smooth point.
I know one of those guys. I know one of those MacArthur. I know a couple of those MacArthur geniuses. Neither of them have loaned me money.
How did I figure that?
Yeah. All I need is 80 grand. I can get,
get 100, right?
Come on, man.
Yeah. Boy. Friends.
I mean, at that point, it's, friends, some genius. I think from, client work, there's always somebody, when's that chair going to be ready? I think some part of it would have to be professional commitment to produce a thing. Like, I got to be on the hook for something.
Here's an opportunity, and you can do whatever you want. I decided back in the mid 90s, I needed to change my life. And I'd been building furniture for 24 years. And I had to figure out something. So I finagled my way into a fellowship at the Vermont Studio Center, where there were mostly painters and writers. And one furniture maker didn't know what the hell he was doing there because there was no equipment. I had a room. That was it.
Yeah.
And yet, I did some drawings. I tried. I remember doing a life drawing class, and I didn't have it. That life drawing is incredibly hard. I don't know if you've ever tried that, but
yeah.
Life drawing is very difficult. And I finally gave up. And at the end of the session, I went up to the model. I said, "Look, I tried really hard. I just, I turned you into a cabinet. I'm sorry. here's this cabinet, and I hope you like it." I just couldn't draw that day. But I had a month and I did come up with an idea and I started a school and that was successful and that was great. But there was, this need to set goals and standards, and it's hard. It is really hard when you're just staring at a blank page and you got no one telling you I need it by 5 o'clock today. You can take as long as you want. That gets tough.
I think that's maybe another place where those kind of shapes come in, where I will make it's one of the things that drives me, that I have the most difficulty with TV writing, where you are one voice of many, and while it might be louder, it is kind of democracy, and some people like an idea and some people don't. And we're, I would rather make a choice, get down the road until it turns out, oh, you know what? Square wheels is not the best shape for a wheel. Okay. And then fix it, then analyze Paul Maudib Atreides style, all of the branching futures that my prescient awareness might have and understand to figure out the best path. Like, let me just pick a pitch and swing, and then we'll see what happens. Like, you know, so in those kind of free forming situations, I tend to make an arbitrary rule just to start the ball rolling. And I might abandon it. You know, I think about this Jack White interview, Jack White from the White Stripes and solo musician now and impresario of, you know, a musical empire. You know, the first three White Stripes records were just guitar and drum. And then the fourth, there's a little bass, there was a keyboard, you know, and I remember reading an interview with him and some snotty rock journalist said, well, you said the White Stripes were only ever going to have guitar and drum on their album. That was the rule. There's only going to be a guitar and drums. And now it's, you got all this other stuff. What's going on? And Jack White's response was, that was a stupid rule.
There you go.
Yeah, it served them well until it didn't. Right. But yeah, just to get I would figure out a shape. I would have to figure out something like, what? Okay, I'm going to write a play. I got this MacArthur grant. Okay, great. I'm writing a play. Fuck, how do you write a play? Or whatever it is. I think I would have to, because otherwise, yeah, no, I'll just stare at the ceiling and think about what a genius I am, not actually do any work.
Oh, you could spend a month doing that easy.
Sure. Yeah.
No, I think you're right. This shape, as you put it, or limits.
Yeah.
I think are really important. And so you start doodling and one doodle leads to another idea, and you're writing words on the page, however you doodle. And a direction starts to emerge out of the mist, out of the fog. But it helps to narrow things down. It really does help. You just can't take on the whole world. I don't think I've told you this story, but I had a client once that, her husband was an architect. She said, make him something. I said, oh, great, love to. I said, what? She said, anything. I said, that's a problem. I want to get paid at the end of this. And if I make him something that he doesn't like, am I going to get paid? I'm going to put all this effort into it. And I just said, nah, I'm going to pass. Perhaps I shouldn't have, but I...
And you didn't feel empowered to decide, oh, it's a cabinet or it's a table,
no,
right?
No, I was still very much in my furniture, left brain phase that, I needed more direction and she was giving me none and I didn't know where to go with it. So what that leads me to, in conversation here is the importance of experience. And I'm looking at a class I'm going to teach this fall. And the first question I'm going to ask people is, well, what are you going to be doing in your shop? And most of them are going to come back with, I don't know. And so there's the, you know, the chicken and egg problem. So you throw the feed across the, It's such a problem because you need the experience to go, oh, well, that doesn't fucking work. Doesn't work. So clearly I can't do that. I have to do this. But until you try that and fail at it, you just don't know. And yeah, these things just don't appear out of the off, you know, Star Trek.
Yeah. It's interesting. I wandered in to class knowing what I wanted to do. Like, I just want to make little boxes. It's interesting. I keep coming back to that. It's an operative metaphor, but like, I like cabinetry, like, and I've done a couple of furniture pieces and like, oh, for the learning experience, but knew while I was doing it, like, I just got to do this once, you know? And I'm, that's not how I think or not where my head goes. It's just for whatever, like, yeah, no, I just want to make boxes. And I remember telling you that, and you went, "Oh, you like cutting lots of dovetails, huh?" It's like, "Oh, I wanted to." I was like, "Oh, I would like to. I want to make an apothecary cabinet." And you were just like, "Oh, you just really love them dovetails."
So harsh sometimes.
No, but it was absolutely. Yeah. But like that was like 100%. Like, yeah, I guess I do. Shit, what?
It can be fun. But it has a different rhythm, and those choices you make, you know, lead you down that path. So that cutting dovetails is what you're going to do, Boyle, and it's nothing but. And the great thing about craft as a endeavor is that you can get better at it.
Right.
You practice and you practice and practice and if you do learn from your mistakes, if you're not insane, then you can get better at it, and then you get to the point where you go, oh yeah, it's just dovetails. Right. They're no longer intimidating. Right. They're just something that you do as part of your day.
I'm sorry to jump in. I have found for me, all of these creative endeavors are not like riding a bicycle. The tools get dull and they get rusty without daily use and care, or near daily use and care. And that was a really big thing to learn. You know, I started off on a fine arts track. And if I'm not drawing every day, all those muscles atrophy. It isn't riding a bike. I there's some things I can retain, but the skill and ability, like it, I want it all to be like riding a bike, and it's not. So that caused like all right. So there's only 24 hours in a day. What craft am I working on?
Well, my apprentice Ali in this podcast will say that he's a dilettante. And so he never has to worry about losing a skill because he'll just go to something else and try something else for a while. Rock climbing or running a marathon or turning on the lathe. So, and just moves from one to another.
Right.
Which brings up the question of mastery and the commitment to that, because there is an obvious commitment that needs to be made to become really skilled at something. Did you ever sit back and say, you know, I'm going to become a really good writer? These things happen just by happenstance. What do you think?
Writing or making comics if no one was reading or publishing them.
There you go.
But what the thought to become a professional writer was giving myself the gift of sucking. Like
that's a t-shirt.
Just the first time someone was gonna publish something that I wrote, I wasn't getting paid for it, and it was never gonna, you know, whatever, but somebody was putting money in. It was a thing. Right. And I was completely paralyzed. I had thought about this form, this art form. I'd been reading it my entire life and making my own my entire life. And suddenly I had to put my money where my mouth was. And it wasn't going to be Citizen Kane. It wasn't going to be an Eames a chair. It wasn't going to be a Mies van der Rohe. It was like, oh no, I'm, oh my God. And I was completely paralyzed. And do you ever see the Tim Burton film Ed Wood?
Yes.
Johnny Depp is, there's a right. bit where he's trying to bluff his way onto a studio lot. And he's like, oh, this is Edward D. Wood Jr., director of Glenda Glenda. And the producer on the other end of the phone goes, Glenda Glenda, that's the worst piece of shit I've ever seen. And Ed just goes, oh, my next one will be better. And that's what I'm calling you about. And there's that line, my next one will be better.
Right.
That was it. The minute I thought, oh, all I have to do is do a next one. This one sucks. The next one is, you know, and that something changed. And I was able to start producing for consumption. And all I knew is I was the only audience I really had to please. I was the only person I had to keep interested. Everything right. else is outside of my control. And this one might suck that, you know, the best thing I ever wrote is whatever I just finished. And the worst thing I ever wrote is whatever just got published. Because all the mistakes are permanent now, right?
Right. But that's a huge thing to be able to say, I just have to please myself. That's a huge thing that I'm still learning.
Yeah. But that it's possible. That's the, in theory, you know, it's like the theory of relativity. Like Einstein spent the first half of his life proving it. And then the second half of his life trying to disprove it. Like, I'm pretty sure I think it's possible. The math is there. I don't know how to get there, but yeah. It's a journey with, and that, I think that's it. Is it made it about craft right away for me? You know, I just knew that I'm going to think about this a lot and I'm going to figure it out. You know, there were days in shop that the best thing I do is the 5-minute dovetail, and it's all downhill from there. Right. But like, you show up and you do it, and hey, tomorrow will be different. Tomorrow will be better. Right. I hope.
Yes, but my experience in college, I thought was unique to myself. I had a creative writing class and a writing teacher who basically hated everything I turned in.
Ooh.
And said, you know, you really suck at this. And I believed him. Mm-hmm. And I shut it down. And it was years later that I went back
to this. You wrote about this in your book a little bit, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I went back to a reunion, and there were these two writers there, and they sort of, and it was in a drama section. I had something written, then I said, there's no description in this. It must be a play. So they gave us permission to be bad or to be good or to try. And that was such a huge thing. And then as I started to write, one of my other teachers, Mary Dawn Duckler, just got in my face and said, do you want to get published or not? Are you, you know, are you in for this or not? You know, if not, then don't bother. And I said, no, I'm kind of sort of, you know, gee, I don't mean to take up too much of your time, you know, sort of mincing, shuffling, you know, not confident pose. And then I understood finally that it didn't suck. That's such a huge step. It's such a huge step for people. And then I found out at that writing class, which is why I brought it up, that there were two other people, and this was an alumni college thing, they call it. So there are people from all years. I mean, there are people from class of 65 and class of 99 and all sorts of 2005. But two or three other people in that same group had the same experience with their creative writing teachers. Yeah. And then I went to the community of writers at Squaw Valley. For a novel that I was trying to pitch and write. And I admitted, there was a memorial for this guy, Gil Dennis, who had been teaching there, and he taught drama and was a screenwriter. And he had a 7 a.m. class, which was, you know, sort of a kick-ass boot camp, honesty, you know, bare your soul drama class. But someone at the memorial said that he went, it turns out, to the same college I did. And someone wrote on one of his papers that he turned in, Drek. And you just go, how do people like that get into these positions of power to just crush people's souls? And it happens, and it continues to happen. I remember going, before I went out to read, I went to visit the New School for Social Research, and I watched it happen in a class. I watched this professor just eviscerate this one female student. And I thought, well, he used to sleep with her and he's getting back or something, but
it's personal and ugly, right?
It was terrible. But that kind of need to belittle people from a position of power is just, turns my stomach.
My dad told a story, and take this with many, many grains of salt, as with most stories he would tell, but he had wanted to be a painter. He had a bad critique and then enlisted to serve in Vietnam for 3 years.
Oh boy.
The way he tells the story was, I left that critique and I went down to the recruiter and I signed up because I had a low number and knew it was coming anyway, and to hell with that. And all right. I had some bad critiques for sure, and I've done some bad work and gotten my ass handed to me before, but I have always in the back of my mind thought, well, all right, but this isn't go enlist in Vietnam bad.
That's pretty harsh.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently they asked if he could, like, all right, he came down on Thursday, and he's like, oh, can I come down a week from Thursday? There's the end of a 2-part Man from U.N.C.L.E. I really want to see. They were like, yes, next Thursday would be acceptable. So
they needed bodies.
Stayed in country long enough to watch the end of a Man from U.N.C.L.E. But really intense critique that were never personal. My teachers were all, and God, I'm talking to one of them again, like very recently, and working on, and it's interesting, in her dotage, all of the edges are gone. She's still her, but all of the kind of spikes have, you know what I mean? It's like her grandma version or whatever, but this woman who could terrify and terrorize rooms, but there was never that. And I think if I was lucky enough to see, it's got to be like sparring. It's got to be like boxing with pads on, because you're trying to learn to be a better boxer. Like, they're throwing punches, they're throwing jabs, you're getting hit, but they're not trying to kill. You know what I mean? To see that, and not only did it help us all just kind of develop toughness, but there was always, like, that's bad drawing. Oh, okay. Yeah. Like that's, at the end of the day, you're a better artist than this. So you should have, it was never dreck. Like, that's awful, right?
Well, please don't mistake my sentiment here. I am all for holding people to standards.
Yeah.
And in fact, in one of my online mastery classes, at the end of the 2 years, one of the students was like, your critiques were so hard. I got just so upset. I'm trying to make you better. I'm not trying to belittle you. Yeah. But people do take it personally.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And understandably, it's very, the work that comes from you, from your hand, whether it's writing or sculpture or whatever you're cooking, this is an expression of some part of you. And so our teachers need to handle this carefully. And but it's a, you and I talked about George Harrison in email. You had that great line. What'd you say?
He's the third best songwriter in the Beatles.
Ouch.
But it's true, right?
It's true. Yeah. Yeah. It's absolutely true. But I found something because I was looking for the song that I'd mentioned to you. And he had done something. He had done an album with Ravi Shankar, the sitar player. And then they had gone on tour to promote the album, and it wasn't being received well. And he got despondent about, you know, Beatle got despondent about his success. Yeah. And I'm thinking, what do you need?
Right.
What do you need in order to be whole? And if you're getting it all from the outside, you'll never be happy. I mean, he was a Beatle, for God's sakes. For those of you who don't know, they were kind of big, huge crowds and an incredibly creative group, and wealthy and yeah, but.
And it was the first band he had been in, and it was over when he was 26.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What does that do to you? What does that do to you?
Yeah.
Well, it's Orson Welles thing, right? Like you start with the greatest film ever made, and then by the end, you're trying to get funding to shoot 2 weeks in Spain.
Yeah. You're on Johnny Carson. You weigh 300 pounds. And that is, I mean, it is. I met a guy. So I had this duplex in Portland, and I was doing it, renting out the other side as an Airbnb, and met this couple from Cirque du Soleil, and they were great. They were really fun people, and he was from LA and had seen the German Ring. Do you know the German Ring? It's basically a giant
the opera, right?
No, that's the Ring cycle. Okay. Now this is an acrobatic performance inside. Remember the picture of Da Vinci with the
Vitruvian man or whatever.
Yeah, and now picture it as a ring, and his hands and his feet are touching it, and he's spinning like a coin you flip onto onto a table.
Okay. Right?
And he goes up and down and does all, and it's called the German Ring. And for 10 years he did it. And he was probably 20 or 21 when he went to clown school in Montreal and learned how to speak French and learned how to juggle and did all this stuff. And then learned how to become.
They honk. The French, they honk totally different. French clowns use the honk honk totally different.
So, you know, this incredibly rigorous life. And it got to the point where, as an athlete, he realized, I don't have it anymore. I can't perform at this level anymore. And so by the age of 30, he was done. Yeah. What do you do?
Call the NFL the not for long league.
Exactly. And if you don't have that sense of self, it's gonna be a tough haul. However long you make it, it's gonna be a tough haul, and that is so important. You can't be looking for that affirmation from outside, and yet it's really great when you get it.
Sure.
So there's the problem,
right?
It's really great when you get it,
you know. And sugar and cigarettes is bad for you, but man, sugar and cigarettes is great.
I gave up smoking, but I love to smoke.
Yeah. It's just been a really long. Yeah, I was so good at it. I was good at it. I was meant for it.
Seven separate moves to get a cigarette lit. Hit my breast pocket, pop out the pack of Camels, hit one against my left hand, pull it out, tap the cigarette, pop out my lighter, flip the lighter open.
It's the accoutrement, right? It's all the little. Oh,
it was the whole thing. It was a performance, and I performed it for myself. And then unfortunately, the first puff of the day was the best. It was all downhill from there.
Ooh. Yeah. I remember when I quit having at some point realizing I used to smoke a pack and a half. Like, where the fuck did I get the time?
You made the time. I need to think. I really need to think about this. I better have sick.
Yeah.
That's what I would do.
It was just
what I would do. Yeah. Constantly coming up with excuses.
I think there's, an aspect of discipline that I'm, you know, how to start? Okay, I'm gonna go three back. I'm Paul McCartney, German mm-hmm. Ring, and cigarettes. Yeah. That Beatles documentary, it's like 19 hours. It's very Get long. Back. Yeah, mm-hmm. and it's, you know, about an album that, if you watch it, you're never gonna have to hear One After 909 ever again. You know, it's like, I wish it was about a stronger album, mm-hmm. but part of the thing is the Beatles have a live performance coming up that they've announced or something. They got nothing in the tank. So it starts with, it's like literally a calendar, and here's when the show day is, and the Beatles have to write an album and they're going to go perform it. And they are really done being the Beatles. They are talking openly about ending and divorce, and it's in the air. Everyone knows the wheels are coming off. They've got this thing that's going to happen. John is with Yoko, and more specifically, more tellingly, like finding really hard drugs for the first time and is completely unreliable. George is 25 and the end is coming, and he can't be heard, and he is the third best songwriter in the Beatles, and he's George fucking Harrison. And look, there's a reason his first solo record was a triple disc set, right? He had three albums of songs raring to go, right? Ringo is going to go shoot the Magic Christian. So Ringo has a hard out. I have to leave London and go to Los Angeles on such and such a day. And we don't get the album done by then. I'm out for 6 months or whatever. And it's a fascinating portrait of creativity and creative collaboration, but also Paul McCartney kept that band together as an act of will. Knowing it was falling apart, talking about breaking up, but like he just sits there and dicks around. And like he and John would talk on their instruments to each other. It was, you get to watch them, like they would just kind of make each other laugh and start goofing around. And then suddenly somebody finds something. Oh, and then Ringo hears it and he starts to kind of tap something out. Oh, George is into it now. George hears it. And then all of a sudden there's the skeleton of Get Back. And he's running a yeah, there you go. And you watch it happen. You're like, he wrote Get Back and Maxwell Silverhammer the same day. And you watch it. Yeah, it was a good Tuesday, right? But that they have a deadline, they have commitments, and Paul knows the only way he can get all of them on the same page. It doesn't play manipulative or anything like that, but it's like it's just, I'm going to do the only thing I know we all know how to do, which is be the Beatles. And it's so great to be the Beatles, and it's so much fun. I know you guys are going to start to follow, and it happens. And it's really fascinating as like a document of creative divorce. And just this Paul, they're about to take a break for a weekend, and you see him at a piano, and you just hear like dun 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 dun. Dun dun dun, and he's like, I'll get it. And then Monday comes in, bum 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 bum. He's got Let It Be done. Like, oh, I found this over the weekend, guys. It just gotta keep going. Gotta keep. It's really terrific. Oh. So the discipline of like, I'm gonna show up and I'm just gonna dick around and see if we can find some magic. How important that is, especially when the well is dry. That's not the time to give up on the well. Right.
And you don't know until you put yourself in that furnace.
Yeah. German Ring had a buddy who was a ball pitcher. Oh, wait, you said I'm sorry. I cut you off.
Oh, no, that's fine. Go ahead.
A buddy was a pitcher, got the call, went up to the bigs, and realized 5 minutes on the team plane, I am the lowest 1% of the top 1%. And this isn't actually what I want to do.
Wow.
I have chased this my whole life. I have it. And it turns out, nope. And it was fascinating, devastating, like, holy shit. What if you What if Indiana Jones gets the thing in his hand? And it's like, oh, this sucks. You know? And then you're like, well, trapped. Yeah. Now I got to pitch until my rope. Now I got to throw until my arm explodes, right?
It's the thing. It's this, you know, destination versus the journey that always comes and rears its head. Oh, you finally made it. This is it. This is what I get.
What's the dog going to do when he catches the car?
Yeah. Right. Well, with the dog, I mean, their brain is just so beautifully simple. They just gnaw on it until it's dead.
You know, I got a great peer, Anatolian Shepherd, Great Pyrenees. You know, he's he's like a wolf. He puts his paws on my shoulder and he looks me in the eye.
Oh wow!
So he gets a car. He might really flip it over. He might at least I believe he could at least take out a scooter, maybe like a low, like a late model.
Oh yeah.
Vespa,
oh yeah.
Perhaps if he ever easy. Gets one.
Oh sure, one comes close enough. Yeah, my neighbor's dog up here in Lyle is a blue heeler, and I ask Vern sometimes. I said, "So is Scott reading to you yet? Because certainly smart enough. What book did she read this week?
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you a baseball story, and I probably should. Been meaning to figure out how to write this. I have to be careful. I know someone. That's it. I know someone who
is it Ryan Sandberg?
No. Okay. who was a great baseball player in New York City, and I don't know if there was a, you know, all city team or, you know, MVP or, but he was like the top player in New York City, grew up in Brooklyn. And, you know, really wanted to go on to a career in professional baseball. And he got two draft letters. And his mom was, let's just call her a piece of work. Mm-hmm. And she gave him one of the draft letters from the U.S. Army, not the draft letter from Major League Baseball. So he went to Vienna and came back, different man, and, you know, not able to perform at that high level or had lost the juice. But, you know, that choice had been taken from him. What a terrible thing. Great guy.
That he found out.
Yeah. And then he found out. So, I can't say much more on.
Yeah.
On this subject, but yeah, just horrible, terrible. Me, my draft number was number two. I was headed straight for it, or straight for Canada, or anyway. Terrible time. Terrible time over a stupid war.
So here's a question: are you a writer that works with wood, or are you a woodworker that writes? Like I remember, because you were telling me about her, like your book is so effortless. The joints are all clean. Everything is proud and true. Nothing about your book feels labored. And like that totally, I remember my first day at art school. It was the first day I ever met an artist. Her signature, her sculpture, her drawings, the way she dressed, all of it looked of a piece. Even the way she would make a pinch pot in sculpture class for slip, I could tell it was Claire's. And it's Claire Cowie. She teaches just outside of Seattle these days. But it was the first time I recognized, oh, you're an artist. All right. Of this is unified. I can tell by your touch, you know? And that's not me, right? And I don't mean that in like a, but that was where like that thing of like, oh, I can grind. I can work on my craft. I can dedicate. I can make, I can with effort compensate for that lack that I sense in myself. But like knowing your pieces and then having read your book, there's a similar sense of like there are, we only see the fingerprints you want us to see. You know what I mean? It feels similarly of a piece. So I'm interested, like, all right, you win the MacArthur grant, you write a book or you make a thing?
Well, both. Yeah, it would have to be both. Yeah. Because I can't, the perfect day is I'm back and forth between the screen here and the shop. Bench there. So that's the perfect day of doing a little bit of both. And as a student, I was just so burnt out that doing something so completely unexpected, because I was, I had some intelligence and went to a school with lots of smart people. And so getting a PhD was sort of, my brother's got a PhD, my sister's got a master's degree. Like, that's what I should do. Now I'm going to just yank the steering wheel and skid off the road and do something just so complete.
Where are you? Youngest, no. Middle?
I'm where? Middle. Okay. I'm the middle. But so I tried. And in fact, it wasn't that far afield. My dad built furniture. I didn't want to have anything to do with them because my dad and I didn't get along. But no one got along with John. But I was around the smell of sawdust, and that really got to me. So I did something completely different. But I was using all that energy I had, and so. I feel really lucky that I became a furniture maker. I would have been, it would have been tough. I would have had to live through deconstructionism. It's just not for me. So, I think there are aspects, two parts of my life that both need to be fed. So I think of myself more as a writer. And teacher, failed woodworker. That's another topic. Need a dive bar now to get into that. I want to try this joke out on you.
Okay.
So there are lots of schools of thought about story, right? There's the Joseph Campbell school, the hero's journey, where there are, these archetypes throughout history that people respond to. And then there's, Christopher Booker's
book, sure.
The Seven Basic Plots.
Yeah.
Why We Tell Stories. Jung influenced analysis of stories, but Seven Basic Plots, doesn't this sound like a klezmer group? The seven basic plots,
PLOTZ, the plots,
plots,
the seven of them,
the seven basic plots, and they come to town and they do their stick and then they leave. All right, so that's it. But it's actually pretty fascinating. Do you think about those things when you're, or are you still? I'm going to just ask this question. Are all your stories overcoming the monster?
Probably to some degree. Being of the Western school, whether I knew it or not, whether any of us are consciously aware of it, I've absorbed that kind of 3 and 5 act structure. On an almost genetic level, it tends to be how I think about things. I like Campbell. I like the hero with the thousand faces a lot. I like the kind of non-Hollywood, I like kind of Campbell writing for students rather than writing for television. You know, I like the real, I love his real scholarly stuff. There's a really terrific book called Into the Woods by John York with an E that is a kind of an examination of the five act structure, which I really, really enjoyed. And he kind of, you know, I think it's an organizing principle that I find that whether I try to or not, everything falls into with my work. You know, there's a beginning, there's a middle and an end, not always in that order.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think the sort of, there's some real dogmatic schools of thought, but I like it as a shape, right? I like it as a structure. And what I really like to do, and I've never shared this or said it out loud to anyone, it occurs to me, so this is all kind of coming out raw, is I will do a kind of, you know, you kind of take your Campbell steps and then I'll do a reverse of those. And that forms the structure that you know, there's a sort of every step on that in that monomyth cycle has its opposite number, and there's presents a shape and a direction, both emotional and internal and external, which all kind of works. But, you know, it's tricky with comics, like with superhero comics, especially with Marvel and DC kind of comics, because like they never end. Like that's the trick. It's all second acts,
right.
You know what have I this is how dumb I am. This is my commercial instinct at play. Was out at dinner with the people who were running DC Comics at the time, and everybody thinks about Batman when they go to DC Comics. I was like, well, my pitch would be, what if Batman wakes up and he's better? What if the thing that makes him dress up like a bat and stay up all night beating people up left him? What if he healed? What if Batman woke up one day and realized, oh my God, I've healed. I don't have to do that anymore. What does that look like? And, you know, don't let the bug poop on the Pop-Tart. You know what people want in their Batman comics? Is Batman dressing up like a bat and beating people up. So, but that was,
you got to understand your character and why people are there. And, you know, there's always that. It's something I've been training myself over the past few years. What am I after? What am I trying to do here? What's my goal? So, oh my goodness, Scout is chasing a wild turkey. Wow.
You got to get an external feed. You got to get a live stream outside so people can get the.
There's Scout. Do you see him?
Hey, buddy.
Yeah.
Aww.
She's a great dog. She is smart as a whip.
Scout would have fun. My big giant horse dog loves little dogs.
Oh, no kidding.
And he will like get on his back and lay down and just let them jump, crawl all over him. It's the funny, he's so sweet, and he doesn't know why they're all, great. Why everyone is so freaked out by him. It's like, cause you're the size of a Volkswagen bug.
Yeah. Yeah. My friend, lived on the steppes of Colorado. So the eastern part of Colorado is just barren. He had one tree on 240 acres where he lived. And he was a rocket scientist, and he had, I don't know, four or five dogs at the time. And I was out walking them, and the leader, the alpha, was a female cattle dog. I don't know exactly what her breed was, but he had this Great Dane. And I'm out walking, right? And I'm looking at vegetation that's about an inch tall. And I'm like, where's the Great Dane? He was right behind me. Was right behind you. They're just the biggest lap dogs, and They're so great. So for those who don't know, the seven basic plots are comedy, tragedy. I'll do it this way. Comedy, the big Lebowski. I picked out some examples. Mm-hmm. Tragedy, Hamlet, tragedy. Voyage and Return, Alice in Wonderland. Rags to Riches, Cinderella, Aladdin, that sort of thing. The Quest, mm-hmm. Lord of the Rings. Star Wars, absolutely. Overcoming the Monster. Star Wars again. Seven Samurai, Jaws, Harry Potter, and Rebirth, Beauty and the Beast.
And Star Wars.
And Star Wars, yeah. Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, writers are known to write stuff, you know, for money and come up with these theories and supposes that, you know, if you just put your coat on, you know, three arms at a time, it'll work. And here are the three arms, or here are the seven basic plots, or here are the 20 basic plots, or here, you know, so everyone's got a recipe. And you got to find your own.
Do you ever see the thing where entertainment editor at some newspaper somewhere was getting a little bit uppity and described the plot of Wizard of Oz as a stranger arrives and commits a murder, then with three friends go after the sister of their victim, which is the plot of Wizard of Oz from a certain point of view, right?
Wow. That's great. I've never heard that,
you know. Or it's just a fun, my kids were bad sleepers, and my son, when I'd put him down, would always go, dad. I'm like, yes. Yeah, buddy. I have questions. And he would just keep talking as long as he could stay awake. And one night he goes, dad, I have questions. Okay, here we go. What's up? And he goes, what does Kung Fu Panda want? And he's a fan of that movie. I'm like, oh, well, he wants to, you know, both be a good son and learn how to do Kung Fu. He's like, okay, what does Master Sifu want? It's like, well, he wants this. And by the time we got to like the kind of third tier of cast, I think all those characters wanted was to be in the movie and to have an action figure, right? And he goes, okay, but then, so then what does Buzz Lightyear want? And we went through all the cast of Toy Story, and I realized that every character in Toy Story wants something different, wants something specific, but wants it in parallel with what the other characters are doing. And like, there's a way to tell the story of Toy Story, or there's a way to tell the story of Star Wars or whatever, as two droids want to make good, right? Or whatever. There's a gambler tries to pay off his debts and becomes a better person in the process,
right?
Or whatever. And like, just that became a fun exercise to start to pick apart. You know, It's a Wonderful Life is one of my favorite movies. All of those characters are starring in their own movie. Even like Bert the cop, Ernie the cab driver, like no one in Bedford Falls is just a waitress. Everyone has some little spin that like, oh, that's a character. Somehow that's a character. Even the guy who tells Alfalfa how to turn on the floor. Who's that dick? Who's that shitty guy? Who's that Iago? Who is the Iago of Bedford Falls? Who's the guy that went up to Alfalfa Switzer and said, hey, you know, they're dancing on a swimming pool? Like, I always think that that's the devil. I think there's a devil working in Bedford Falls the way Clarence the Angel is working.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I just that's a that's a discipline I lack, because feeling done feels so good that I just want to move on to the next thing. I wish I had the discipline to proofread. I wish I had the discipline to do multiple passes earnestly and like, okay, and now I'm going to make sure that Mr. Potato Head has a unique point of view, desire, arc of this draft. And now I wish I had that discipline and I don't. But those little games help unlock it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, as someone who combs the hair of his little darlings, that is, goes and re-edits and re-edits and re-edits and re-edits. My first drafts, what is it? They have the gift of sucking. They really do. Those first drafts are something terrible. And even sometimes stuff that I thought was really polished, this often happened when I was writing for Fine Woodworking Magazine. I'd get a proof back of the article and they'd say, take a look at this, see if there's any mistakes. And I'd read it and I'd go, this sentence here sucks. This is terrible. I can't allow this out. And I'd go look at my original text. I had written that.
It was you. Yeah.
It was me.
Yeah.
And I was outraged.
Although, you know, there's a corollary that's just as embarrassing of in comics. I will compliment something that one of my collaborators have put in somewhere, some detail, some bit of business they did. I'm like, oh, I love that. I love that you put that in there. They're like, yeah, you dick, that was in the script. No, I just complimented myself. Okay.
Yeah. Well, no, you recognize genius. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? It's just it's a cross people have to bear. So, take a look at my notes here. See if there's anything else I need to clean up on aisle 7. I don't know if you know this book. It's by Bernard Malamud's daughter, Jana Malamud Smith. Mm-hmm. And it's an okay book. Another book on creativity. This one's called An Absorbing Errand, which is a William James quote. Mm-hmm. But she talks about the disheartening sensation of being creative, that there's a necessary anxiety that gets produced when you're trying to create stuff. Do you experience that, or is it all bliss and heaven?
No, but it's labor I don't mind. Uh-huh. You ever do like distance running?
In high school, yeah. That's why I got bad knees now. But yeah, not that much.
I'm out of practice now, but a while back, for no discernible reason, I decided I was gonna be a distance. I ran a half marathon, but like went from the couch to running a half marathon as quickly as I could, and at some point, I hated it. I hate it, and like the ADHD and stuff, like just the sameness and just, oh. And then I broke through that and realized, oh, I need this. This is a thing that makes my brain better, right? There's something similar. Like I think for me that there came a point of kind of realizing like, oh, ideas are the easy part. Everybody has ideas. Creativity is, you got chocolate and you got peanut butter. What if you put them together? Like, oh, that's the waiting for the right Lego to snap together. I don't know that it's anxious, but I sure get depressed when it dawdles.
Mm.
You know?
So
it'll happen, but I just wish it could. I wish it happened on command.
Oh, well, that's, everyone wishes that, but the great quote by Elmore Leonard, the what do we call him? Tough guy, mystery writer, Get Shorty. That stuff is, he said, writing's easy. All you do is stare at the page until the blood comes out on your forehead. So, I think you're absolutely right. Ideas are easy. Everyone has ideas. Everyone has 1,000 ideas in a day. You know, they're just kind of fast streaming on that brain pan of yours. I mean, it's
make a table. That's a great idea.
Yeah, it's a terrific idea. And but the effort required in making a table. I had a little repair to do on a little dining table of mine, and I have it apart. And I looked at the tabletop. It's sitting on a bed. And then the tabletop is there. And I went, that looks great. Boy, it takes a lot of work to make a tabletop. I mean, it just takes a lot of work. It's a lot of effort. And they just don't. It's like writing a novel. It just doesn't happen in a weekend, which is why it really pisses me off. I love Kurosawa. And he sat down with two other writers, and they wrote Seven Samurai in like 2.5 weeks. Come on. Yeah. Give me a break. you know, it's just hard enough. There's geniuses out there. That's just not fair. But I'm a huge fan of his stuff.
Well, I went to Toho Studios in Tokyo.
All right.
And I don't remember if I told you this. They took me to the secret room where the Godzilla suits are. Oh. And behind them are baker's racks full of, you know, like little crates. I'm like, what's that? And I go, oh, those Kurosawa's cameras and lenses. And all these behind the scenes pictures, you know, from you know, it used to just be that all, you know, a little factory building in the middle of a field, but it's all, you know, oh, now look, that's where those apartments are now. And that's where they shot this. And that's where they shot. Here's everybody on the set of Red Ghost. And, you know, it's just terrific.
Like, yeah. And yet he was working, you know, very methodically. I mean, it's, I say I got pissed, or I am pissed at his genius, but that creative burst comes from lots of work beforehand.
Right.
And that's why it's possible. It's not, you know, there were people like Mozart, and there still are, but the rest of the schmoes got to work at it.
Visions come to prepared spirits, right?
There you go.
You know the story of the benzene ring and how Koichel mapped the benzene ring? It was like they couldn't figure out that it was a ring. They knew it's a chemical. We know it exists, but they couldn't figure out what it was. And he worked on this for, you know, 40 years, and one night had a dream of a Ouroboros, whatever the word is, a snake eating its tail. And he woke up and he realized, oh, it's a ring. And he solved the problem.
Right.
And I don't remember if he'd like won the Nobel Prize or whatever, but someone someday was being feted for his discovery, and someone said, boy, I wish I could just go to sleep and dream up all the answers to my problems. He's like, yeah, no, I dreamed it right up after 30 years.
Right. Right.
Visions come to prepared spirits.
Yes. And that's the discipline required to put in that time. It's not easy, but if you can get yourself to the easel, the pen, the bench. Yeah, no guarantees, but things do come. Things do come, and sometimes they come early in your career, which is over by the age of 26, and sometimes they take 30 years.
Or maybe you're like, God damn it, Terrence Malick. You make two movies and then it's, or Stanley Kubrick made, what, 9 movies, something like that. You know, some people take a long time. And Malick's gotten a little faster as he's gotten older. He's, but like for a long time, he had two films. He made Badlands and Days of Glory. And then 30 years later made The Thin Red Line. And like, it's like he woke up and realized, oh man, I'm 60. I better get to making all these movies I wanted to make.
Well, that's the thing. Particularly in this time. Okay, what have you done lately? Come on, what's next? Mm-hmm. All right, you wrote a novel. What's your next novel about? And they don't just pop out. They're not Pop-Tarts.
Yeah.
You don't just secrete a frosting on top. You've got to, it takes work. And sometimes, you think back to, I think back to James Joyce. Hey, he's got like 3 books out. That's it. Mm-hmm. What good is that? You know, Portrait, well, Ulysses, and then that other one that's unreadable.
Or Dickens, right? Dickens was writing for pennies in chapters published in the newspaper because he had debt.
Right. Yeah.
Now that's art. That's like building the bridge while you're on it. That's, oh my God.
Well, that effort is, yeah. Well, we were talking about Melville over breakfast.
Yeah.
And he was what? Was he in the post office or is that someone else?
Well, yeah, no, he ended up, after his books didn't work and he ended up post office or patent office, something like that.
Yeah. And not everyone has that skyrocket ride. But I am convinced, and this is perhaps naive of me even still, that when you're on that buzz train, that you've got an idea and it's working, and it's sometimes, so I wrote a piece yesterday and it just everything clicked and I wrote it in half an hour and it made me laugh. And if it does that, boy, I'm in heaven. And that kind of immersion into an experience is why I do this work, whether it's at the bench or writing, it's that sense of flow that I think is just so great. And you can't get that from so many other things that we try. It just doesn't. Being creative is its own reward. There, that's it. That's the naive statement. Go ahead.
No, I don't think it's, I don't think it's naive. I think the question is it a reward that, will satisfy people? I think there are those of us who are satisfied, like I'm never going to work in a bank. I knew that. I always knew that. I just, whatever I ended up doing, it wasn't, I just knew I wasn't cut out for anything but some form of this life. And if I couldn't live it and make a living on it, I knew that I'd be the, smartest guy at the whole Taco Bell, racing home at night to go do whatever, paint my garage or do whatever. Like I never had any illusions that I was cut out for the straight world.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the people who are creative know early on that they're somehow different.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't. At that Vermont Studio Center, I put this in my book, that I met a guy there who, after 2 weeks, he was a poet. And he said, it's just so good to be around people who understand how lonely I feel. Because the rest of the world that, he was a middle school teacher or something, they just don't get it. They just don't understand.
Yeah, I remember. This, I don't know. Maybe this kind of discipline before discipline, but I remember like thinking about adults with jobs and like, okay, but what do you do when you go home? What do you? What do you do? You're just gonna sit and watch TV? Like, you're gonna go ride a bike? Oh, like, what do you? Okay, but like, you worked at a bank all day or whatever. Like, what? Like, okay, but now what are you going to work on?
I have to relax.
That is relaxing. That is how I relax.
Yeah. Right. Woman, where's my drink? I'm channeling my father. Matt, it has been a pleasure. My great pleasure to have this conversation with you. Thank you for joining me.
Gary, thank you so much.
Well, let's go get a taco and
let's go point at bankers when they come out and point and laugh at all the bankers going home.
Oh man. Yeah. All right. Let me I think we got enough.
This is great.
2 hours, my God. Mm-hmm.